You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's estimated that China will send 1 million people to work on farms in Africa this year. It's part of a growing trend of rich countries buying up large amounts of farmland in poor countries. And joining me now to discuss these land deals and their impact is John Parker, globalization correspondent for The Economist. His article on outsourcing farming appeared in that publication's May 21st issue. And Joachim van Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute. I'm very pleased to welcome them to this week's Underreported. Hello.
Hi, thanks for inviting us.
I mentioned China. What other countries are buying up farmland in foreign countries?
Do you want me to go?
Either one of you. Okay. Why don't you start, John?
Okay. There are two main areas of the world that are doing the buying. One is kind of East Asia. China and South Korea is very big. And the other big area is the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. And what these countries have in common is that they've got a lot of money. They've got very large foreign exchange reserves, so they've got money to spend. But they've got real food problems, and in particular, water shortages. So they've got the money, and they're looking to use it for food security.
And why aren't they just importing food from other countries as most people do?
Basically because they don't really trust world food markets. They learned from the food crisis of 2007-08, first of all, that food prices are very volatile. If you remember, prices of wheat and rice and so on almost doubled in that period. They really spiked. Now, they've fallen since then. They've really spiked. That is to say, they've gone up and then down again. But still, that was a very kind of destabilizing experience for them. And what was worse was that during that period, a lot of food exporting countries put export controls on their grain. They said, food prices are shooting up. We need to secure our own supplies. So we're going to either tax or in other ways prevent food leaving our territories. So, you know, Argentina, which is a very big grain exporter, did this. And so they thought not only would food be a lot more expensive, but there was even a risk that even though they've got a lot of money, they might not be able to get it. So they sort of thought, well, they looked around and thought, what can we do? One of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that they decided to say is, okay, it would really guarantee our supplies if we actually owned the land and grew it ourselves and shipped it back.
Joachim, that sounds like the sort of thing that we saw in the 19th century with the Banana Republics.
Well, the Banana Republics were prevalent in the 20th century. And if you refer to the 19th century, so the last 200 years, it's the perspective of land grabbing was gets a different dimension. So all land was grabbed in North and South America and in Australia. But I think that's not the topic we are talking about today. Actually, it's good that the world is paying attention to today's tendencies of land investment and the complex, also risky issues around it. The world didn't pay much attention in the old days. If we look at, say, a big case among the foreign direct investments, Saudi Arabia stands out, as John has already mentioned. The King Abdullah's initiative for agriculture investment abroad is very much driven by the concern for secure supply of the kingdom's citizens. That's clearly mentioned. Saudi Arabia, where President Obama visits these days, has sent out teams to a number of countries, to Sudan, to Egypt, Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, Vietnam, and a few others, over the last few months to identify opportunities to make special deals for long-term leases and purchases of land. Where they would also have certain rights in the future as foreign investors, that they, for instance, could export under all circumstances the products which they have produced there through their investments, and leaving some of the products in the host country if needed is the phrase which the investment proposal under the King Abdullah Initiative Plan has.
Because one of the problems is, you mentioned a couple of countries that we always associate with not being able to feed themselves, Sudan, Ethiopia. They're making deals to have other people grow crops there or to have crops grown there, even if they can't feed their own people?
Yeah, that's really the risky aspect of it. I mean, imagine the trucks with grain driving by starving people in order to feed the animals in the rich countries, in the Gulf states or elsewhere in the world. That would not go down well and would lead to all sorts of political implications. But let me add an additional point here. For instance, Saudi Arabia has shifted its food security policy to foreign direct investment is not only because of the very important reason that the trust in trade was lost last year, as already mentioned, but also because they realized that pumping their scarce water resources at high energy costs and huge subsidy costs in order to grow wheat in the desert just doesn't make sense. And they have come to that conclusion over the last 2 years and stopped these subsidies since 2 years, producing wheat at 7 times the world prices. And that's an additional impetus for the investment.
Well, I want to address that in just a moment because some of the places they're going to have water problems as well. Ethiopia has a serious drought. But you mentioned something I want to get to John on this. These countries are coming to Africa and South Asia and getting land. Who are they getting the land from? Are they making deals with the government or are they making deals with the farmers who, I assume, own the land?
Very good question. Classically, they are doing a deal with the central government in Khartoum or in the capital, and the government is leasing or selling them land that it claims it owns. Right?
And what do the farmers who are farming that land say?
They usually say, we own this land, it's wasteland or scrub land, or land, not otherwise properly being used. So there's no real problem because, it's not being farmed at the moment.
The problem
it may well be that the government formally owns the land.
That's
They've
the point,
They've got the title
yeah.
to it. But in fact, there are thousands, maybe even millions of people who've been farming that land, living off that land, grazing their cattle off that land for generations. Now they don't have title to the land. They just used it. They've got customary rights, but that's not recognized in law. So frequently you get these deals where the Chinese or another government will sign a deal with the national government for, let's say, a million acres or something like, a really large amount. But then when you actually get down on the ground, you get a lot of opposition to it. And the farmers find out that their land's been sold by a rather distant central government, say, no, we're not going to move.
That's what happened in Mozambique, isn't it?
Well, it happens in various places, and there is no court where these farmers and their communities can go to because they have no legal title. So the land grabbing issue really raises the whole question of land ownership and legal title in new ways. And whereas titling projects were considered very expensive in the past, and the international aid agencies and the national governments stayed away from them because it costs a lot of money to register land and measure it and so on in Africa, This will change now because the legal insecurity around these deals are also not in the interest of the external investors. But the deal-making currently is either made with central government or with local government, and the capture of parts of the cake locally by local elites is what we are particularly concerned about. That's where the small farmers and especially the herders, people who use rangeland, will lose.
I'm talking with Joachim von Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, and John Parker, Globalization Correspondent for The Economist. We're talking about outsourcing agriculture on today's Please, Underreported. I mentioned Mozambique. There was a very powerful reaction to a deal like this in Mozambique, wasn't there? And there's also there's been a destabilization of the government in Madagascar.
Well, Madagascar's the extreme case. So a South Korean company called Dayu signed a deal for over about 2 million hectares, more than that, which was really a stunning amount because it was half the country's arable land. And this became a sort of a point of ammunition between two rival groups in the opposition and the government, and became one of the kind of core celebres in the battle between the two, and helped fuel the flames of opposition to the government, which was actually overthrown. And one of the very first things that the new government did when they kicked out the president was to scrap this deal that he had previously signed with Dayu. There's another gigantic deal in the works in Zambia, where the leader of the opposition in Zambia, this is a deal with China, has said he wants nothing to do with it. And for earlier, not to do with this one, to do with another one, the Chinese said, if this guy ever comes to power, we're going to pull out of the country. So you do get substantial opposition at the local government. These are extreme cases. You get substantial local opposition in the countries concerned. These are extreme cases, but even at a sort of lower level case, where we were talking just now about the sort of problems of the central government making a deal and then finding it very hard to make it stick locally. In Pakistan, the same thing is going on. The Pakistani government, the central government, has been trying to lease out large amounts of land, but one of the provincial governments in Balochistan has said, no, we don't want anything to do with this. So you do get quite a lot of conflicts. You get state and local government conflicts, and you get central government versus sort of the people, and opposition versus government conflicts. So it does set off a sort of chain of opposition.
Well,
let me come to the Mozambique.
Well, I want to clear up one thing before we do. When you talk about hectares, we're talking about a hectare equaling 2.5 acres, right?
Yeah, more or less, right.
These are huge areas.
Yeah. I mean, if you total it all up, it's basically the size, the amount of farmland that there is in France. Or yeah. I think France is roughly the size of Texas.
That's what our adding up shows, that it's about the total deals talked about, not settled, put on notice and registered, are about 15 to 20 million hectares, talking hectares again. That's about French crop area. Relatively speaking, to the total cropped area of Africa, it's minuscule. Let's not forget that so far. But we are operating in an environment where land markets practically don't exist. So many of these deals include laughingly low payments for leases of, say, $3 to $10 US dollars a hectare, or less than half of that per acre, which sounds like a very good deal. But in order to run these projects, they have to invest in roads and electricity infrastructure and all sorts of things. But coming back to some of the diversity, countries like Mozambique and Angola have indeed big tracts of unused land and mismanaged water, and are in urgent need for good capital investment in agriculture, not necessarily all at large scale. And a lot of the investment targeted in Mozambique, which to my knowledge has so far not led to any conflicting situations which led to uprisings or protests, are around biofuels. I think these investments can be good or bad, like any investments, and require a good code of conduct. We need around all these deals good supervision, strong adherence to codes of conduct against corruption, local exploitation, and environmental mismanagement. And I'm very pleased that the government of Japan has put this on the G8 agenda next month in Italy, the land grabbing issue, and make it solid investment rather than exploitation.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more of this with my guest, Joachim von Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, and John Parker, Globalization Correspondent for The Economist, whose article on this subject is in the May 21st issue of The Economist. Stay with us for more. We're talking about outsourcing agriculture on today's Underreported with John Parker, globalization correspondent for The Economist, and Joachim von Braun, the Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute. And we mentioned earlier that two of the biggest investors in foreign agricultural land are South Korea and China. But don't they have huge agricultural sectors of their own? In fact, if anything, haven't they seen agricultural expansion in recent years? John?
Yes, they have. But you must remember, take the case of China. China's become noticeably richer over the past 20, 30 years. And one of the things that happened as you get rich is your diet changes. And you stop eating quite so much grain, and you switch over to eating much more meat. And China has gone from eating something like, I can't remember the exact amount. They've increased the consumption of meat, especially pork, by a factor of about 7 or 8. And meat in general is much, much greedier of water than grain is. So it requires also about 7 or 8 times as much water to grow the same amount of calories of meat as it does to grow that same number of calories of grain. So as they become richer, they become much kind of greedier of water. And so they've been using up water at a fantastic amount. And the North China Plain, which is their largest, let's say a sort of grain basket area, you know, that's the equivalent of the Midwest for them, has had terrible, terrible water shortages. The main river, the Yellow River that goes through it, no longer reaches the sea. So they, like the Saudis, though, you know, not for quite such sort of dramatic reasons, are extremely concerned about their water and about, you know, sustaining the agricultural land that the water keeps going. So they're also concerned about their food security.
But Joachim, some of the countries that they're going into have had serious water and drought issues of their own. Aren't some parts of Africa expected to even be harder hit than other regions by climate change?
Actually, the whole world will be much shorter in water. The implicit price of water is drastically increasing with the food price, and global warming looming, especially also over China, with water stress and heat stress, will make it so much more difficult to increase agricultural productivity. Africa will be hit hardest by climate change, especially close to the equator and in parts of the Mediterranean. For instance, Morocco is one of the 5 countries which has to expect the biggest losses. But all in all, the water resources of Central Africa, Congo Basin, and the Upper Nile, those waters are still used far less than the six big rivers of Asia. And there is scope for increased productivity. So per dollar invested, or per million or billion dollar invested, you get more crops out of Africa in the next 30 years than in most parts of Asia, and in China in particular.
John, it's estimated that 1 million Chinese farm workers will be sent to Africa to work on farms there. Why don't they just employ local workers?
They trust their own people more, is the short answer to that. This is, I think, a major, major part of the worries about these land grab problems. You know, what the locals see is the land that they're accustomed to using as grazing, whatever, sort of being taken over from them, and they're not even working on it. You know, they're being, as it were, as in their views, thrown off the land, and people from outside being brought in. Now, I think it is fair to say that these projects vary a great deal. And some of them are in practice a kind of contract farming, so that the people buy or lease the land and they contract with the existing farmers to say, okay, you know, we'll give you access to fertilizers and credit and so on, and we'll buy your crops off you. And that's, you know, on the face of it, that should work well. There's no particular reason why that should cause trouble of this kind. But in parts of Africa, you already find a great deal of kind of, you know, anti-foreign opposition to Chinese workers. So, you know, that is a major problem. It's not, as I said, it's not characteristic of every one of these deals, though.
And then China has secured the rights to grow palm oil on 2.8 million hectares in Congo. That's what, about 8 million acres. Why are they interested in creating what would be the world's largest palm oil plantation, Joachim?
Palm oil is a very important raw material for lots of foods, and it happens to be the cheapest cooking oil if you disregard the value of rainforests and of nature. And that's what's happening here. And the expansion of palm oil production in the Philippines and in Indonesia, where most of that stuff is grown, has reached limits, and it's no longer acceptable there. But Congo Basin is an area with vast agricultural potentials. And co-investing in agriculture and in mineral destruction does make sense from a foreign perspective. So it's sort of a double gold rush happening there. The land values are increased because of the food prices are up, over the oil and mineral boom last year, the expectations then and in the longer term future are that those resources are high in value. So the two have come together in Congo, and out of that, unfortunately, is coming still a lot of conflict, which may undermine the real potential. So I think China's engagement there and in other parts of Africa actually is a lot more sophisticated than from many of the investors in the Gulf states. China simultaneously has invested in 11 new agriculture research stations in Africa in order to support agriculture productivity. That makes a lot of sense. And in agriculture, I don't see so many efforts by China to bring in their own laborers. That's more in infrastructure and mining, and has actually raised protest in Zambia. So I think we are on a learning curve, which is pretty steep, I think actually China's and South Korea's engagement in Africa I'm not so concerned about, because they know how to run small farm agriculture. They don't go typically straight into the plantation business, which is bad for the local communities.
But they're not only going to Africa. A deal that China was trying to make with the Philippines for over 1 million hectares was blocked. Do we know why?
The Philippines have gotten very concerned about their own food security during the last rice price crisis, and any investor in the Philippines who does not add value and surplus to domestic grain markets will run into political trouble. And that, as far as I know, was the case there. So it's similar to the Madagascar case, with which I think was out of proportion and was inappropriately communicated, but might not have been that bad in the end for Madagascar, the deal which John referred to earlier from South Korea.
I'm talking with Joachim von Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, and John Parker, the globalization correspondent for The Economist, on today's Underreported. John, your article on the May 21st issue of The Economist was called Outsourcing's Third Wave. Is this like other kinds of outsourcing, like manufacturing? From a business standpoint, are these agricultural deals very different from other foreign investment deals?
Well, I would say it is a little bit different. Because the classic outsourcing for manufacturing is part of a supply chain, so that you will make kind of nuts and bolts in one country and then, you know, screw them into a machine and into an engine into another, and then ship the engine to make it into, you know, the car part bodies in a third, and then maybe you'll ship the nearly finished car to kind of customize or something somewhere else. So there's a real chain. Whereas this is a chain with really only two points. You know, it's the classic pattern here is simply you grow it in one place and you ship it back home and there and you eat it there. In principle, it could become more like a chain, and indeed this is happening in a few places where, for example, somebody might go in and create a kind of food processing factory and then use contract farming with the farmers surrounding it, and then, you know, use their cocoa beans, say, you know, to process into chocolate. And then, you know, you then ship that chocolate in, you know, for sale abroad. So you could imagine it becoming a little bit more like an industrial supply chain, but frankly, at the moment, it's not.
Have these farms in Africa and elsewhere had a high success rate?
Well, we don't know, because typically farms take, you know, probably minimum of like 3 years to get even the first result, and this trend is probably only 2 or 3 years old. We're only getting the very early examples. But one would have to say that the record of big commercial farms, especially those run by foreigners in Africa, in which somebody's come and said, hey, I've got a great idea, I'm going to create a gigantic peanut farm somewhere, and we're going to, you know, have 10,000 hectares or more, it's been pretty disastrous, that record.
Well, that's the British tried to do that in 1940s.
We tried to do that in Tanzania.
Well,
it was one of the most disastrous sort of agricultural experiences.
Should have consulted with Jimmy Carter. He knows how to grow peanuts. Is this all just government and government? Are any corporations and private investors getting involved in this as well?
There are government to government. Most of the ones that we've been talking about have been government to government. There are private investment. There's a large amount of private investment in the former Soviet Union, where after the Soviet Union collapsed, they privatized the collective farms and the state-owned farms, and then private farmers came in to buy those farms. So that happened on quite an extensive scale. And then there are sort of intermediate steps whereby people like Goldman Sachs and other hedge funds have created sort of agricultural investment vehicles, and they've bought up private farms. And
Morgan Stanley has bought several thousand acres in the Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good example. And then you have something which is somewhere in between the government and what I've just described, which is the sovereign wealth funds of Gulf states. Now, are they private or are they public? That's not so clear. I usually categorize those as public because they're very frequently influenced by the sort of strategic considerations of the governments. And they're, even though they may well be, you know, technically private companies, they're doing the government's bidding. I talked a little bit earlier about the deal in Madagascar. That, of course, was actually done by a private company, by Daewoo, rather than by the South Korean state. But it was done sort of with the encouragement, or let's say, of the South Korean government. So there's no bright line here between the public sector and the private sector.
Now, Joachim, we talked earlier about the Saudis going to different places. They have visited Australia, Brazil, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, the Philippines, South Africa, Sudan, Turkey, Ukraine, Vietnam,
to
discuss land acquisition. Some of those countries, Australia, Brazil, South Africa, Turkey, I can't imagine that they would want to sell off their land.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't come to Iowa. But this is really a mix of objectives here. It's partly commercial. You want to invest in secure deals. That's why Saudi Arabia goes to some of the countries which you mentioned. But also to countries where there's some good relationship to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's explicitly mentioned in the investment plan of the so-called King Abdullah Initiative. I think to relate your question to the earlier discussion, I think a big issue is that lack of transparency around these deals. Many of the so-called private investors are really shadow public investors, say provincial governments from China or corporations with major shareholders being governments, also from the Gulf states. And I think it's a key issue that the transparency is becoming more clear, and that's where the media have played actually a very good role. We wouldn't talk about this today if there wouldn't have been early cries from the research community, such as my institute, which was really then very much followed up by the media, and the media investigative journalism really played a brilliant role to bring these stories to the international attention.
Now, John,
I think it's a unique story of where I think investigative journalism over the last 12 months has really shown its brilliance and its importance. And that needs to go on until we have legal clarity and good code of conduct.
John, Joachim talked about secure deals. Well, in Sudan, South Korea has signed deals for 690,000 hectares of land. The United Arab Emirates has signed a deal for 400,000 hectares. Why are they willing to invest in Sudan at a time when there's a humanitarian crisis going on and its president has been indicted by the International Criminal Court?
Because it's cheap.
Well, I will just say this about Sudan and in general. One of the things that we do need to understand, that however bad these deals sound, they're not, and I'm going to sound like an apologist for these deals now, I realize that, but I don't want people to think that I think they're great, but they do have advantages. And you have to understand these advantages to understand why it's happening so much. Southern Sudan and Central Sudan, where the Nile, the up area of the Nile, the upriver in the Nile, contains some very, very, very rich, fertile agricultural land, which has lain sort of unused, really, for decades. It's partly because of poor government in the Sudan. There are other reasons.
Well, there's been conflict in the south.
Not so much in this area, in southern Sudan, but it's north of that. It's around Khartoum. It's in the Gezira, and it's actually potentially magnificent farmland, and it's been sort of neglected. There's been no local investment for ages and ages and ages. There's been some, frankly, rather poor investment by Western donors there, and so I think one shouldn't rule out in advance the possibility that people going in there can make good farmland, potentially good farmland, much more productive than it is. And so, you know, the optimistic take on this is that when these investors go into Sudan, they might, and I stress might, make a better job of it either than the Sudanese government have or than Western donors have over the last, you know, 10, 20, or indeed in the case of Sudan over the last 100 years.
But there's also a tradition in Sudan of land grabbing by local elites. Thousands of hectares in South and North Kordofan and parts of Darfur have been handed out in the 1970s and 80s to militarily loyal leaders, and that land has been taken away from local farmers who have then squeezed closer to the desert, and out of that came part of the reason, the fundamental reason for the Darfur crisis. So I think we need to talk also more and more in the future about local land grabbing and land shoddy land deals, which don't involve the foreigners. And Sudan has a very unfortunate tradition in that respect in northern Sudan. I fully agree with John's assessment around the south and the Gezira.
Well, we will address that in a future underreported segment, and I hope you gentlemen will participate. I want to thank you so much, Joachim von Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, John Parker, Globalization Correspondent for The Economist. Thank you for making this underreported segment on outsourcing agriculture so informative.
Okay. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.